World War II, a time of unrelenting global trauma, stretching from 1939 to 1945. It involved all of the great powers of the time. It was the most destructive episode in the history of civilization. It required its major forces to dedicate their entire military, economic, industrial, and scientific capabilities to the cause of warfare. Estimates of the death toll vary, from 50 million to 85 million worldwide. World War II took the art of war to new and appalling heights through massacre, genocide, remorseless bombing raids, starvation, disease, and the first use of nuclear weapons. In this series of interviews, under the title World War II in Words, we encounter 20 veterans of the conflict. When interviewed during 2017, all 20 were well into their 90s, living in quiet retirement in South Australia. Their personal accounts and their experiences of the conflict, though, were rich in action and diversity, reflecting the capacity of war to change lives and challenge the ability to survive. Their words serve as a lasting record of what it was like to live through those momentous years. To demonstrate the shock of that era, first up, Jack Thomas of the 2nd-3rd Australian Machine Gun Battalion. He'd been working in the family grocer's shop in Broken Hill and would soon find himself a slave labourer on the Burma Railway and in a Japanese coal mine. His determination to survive was nurtured by a senior officer with whom he served, Lieutenant Colonel Edward Dunlop, the surgeon nicknamed Weary, who would subsequently be knighted for unfailing courage under duress. 72 years after the end of World War II, Jack Thomas reflects on his own history of triumph over adversity. Jack, you came from Broken Hill, son of a grocer, born in 1920. Early life through the Depression must have been pretty hard.
Well, I'm afraid that when we get old, we think mainly about the things that we've done in the past because we can't see much of the future. When we think of the past, our mistakes stand out in huge relief. And I look back on those early days with a great deal of sadness because my father had this small grocery shop. He had a family of four children at school when his wife died, who died at the age of 41. And my dad was left to care for these four children at school. Because he had a small grocery shop, he needed to think of the future. I was the likely future of the grocery shop. It was not something I looked forward to. And like most other young people of my age, I was a little bit upset at the prospect of having to work in a grocery shop when I had other ideas. And a little bit of the... I don't like to use words that are improper, but young people do become difficult. They don't understand their parents. They can't understand the parents' aspect, the way a parent must look at life because he's responsible for the lives of his family. I could not see his responsibility. And I left school without telling my dad that I wanted to leave school. So I left school at the beginning of fourth year of high school. In retrospect, it was a huge mistake. I should have stayed longer. I joined the army without consulting my father. All the time my father would have been thinking, where does his future lie?
Why had he picked on you amongst the siblings to be his successor in running the shop?
I had a wonderful brother, 2 years my senior. He became a mine manager. He had talent. I did not have any common sense, let alone talent. And I was a leftover. My brother Bill was never going to be the operator of a small grocery shop.
And the other two siblings?
The other two were juniors to me. Two sisters, Dora and Jeanette. They were both junior to me. And they were both at that stage, well, one was very junior. And the other sister, Dora, would have been in primary school. And it was a tremendously difficult time for my father, and I felt nothing but sadness in my later years when I think of how I let my father down.
And I don't want to upset you, but nevertheless, you say that come 1940, when you were turned 19, you were nearly 20, you left Broken Hill and you enlisted in the armed forces.
Correct.
Was that to serve your country or to get away from Broken Hill? What was the motivating factor?
Remember that when I went to a kindergarten school, kindergarten and primary school, the King of the realm was King George V. We flew the flag for King George V. I was very much a subject of the British Empire. That feeling still resides with me. I still have this feeling. I still see the flag at the Morgan Street Kindergarten School. And that's where my impulses came from. The feelings I had as a young child, I had a loyalty to the Crown. I think I still retain that. It was difficult for me, perhaps, just to leave home and join the army, but I had two companions my age who also joined the army. So perhaps it was the thing to do.
Must have been a remarkable experience to join up, do your training, then be sent off to the Syrian campaign and see so many exotic sights on the way.
I remember one of the persons in the train that I departed from Broken Hill to go to Adelaide for my enlistment. His name was Arthur Main. I didn't know him well. He was a person who would escort you to your seat if you went to the movies at night. As we neared Adelaide, we saw some members of the army in uniform. And there were about seven or eight of us in the train on that occasion. And Arthur said, "There we are, lads. There are your cloaks of glory." Well, he rang a bell with me. I thought, yes, that's right. I'll do my bit for the Crown. So it just cemented the idea that I belonged to the British Empire and the army was the right place for me. And I had little thought for what I was leaving behind, which was a huge mistake.
What are your recollections now of your first encounter on active service, coming under fire? What do you see, what do you think, what do you smell, what do you sense when you reflect on that now?
They say a soldier's life is mostly boredom. From time to time you get shot at. I got shot at all right, not all that much. I don't know that I killed too many people, if I killed any. I had no leave. I put my 5 shillings a day was mainly allocated back home. So when I was overseas in Palestine, when there were sights to be seen, I did not see them, other than compounds of Italian and German prisoners of war. Well, I was cocky enough to think that we'd already won the war when I saw all those prisoners behind wire. I thought, that's a good job, they can stay there. We'll go on and finish the war and we'll win it and everything will be pio.
So you were from there dispatched to Java in a disastrous campaign where men were separated from weapons and vehicles and the unit was split up and you drew the short straw and you were captured by the Japanese, became a prisoner yourself.
I was indeed. I was captured by the Japanese when the entire Dutch East Indies was surrendered to the Japanese. And I was in Java at the time. And I had been actively involved with the Japanese forces. Not to a desperate level. And my involvement was brief. On March the 8th, the Dutch East Indies were surrendered. And my life up until that stage just became history.
Yes, from March the 8th, 1942, prisoner of war from Java. You were taken where? What happened next year?
Being in Java, I was my first my first permanent camp, so to speak, was at a Dutch army base. I just can't think of the name of the city now. But there I got to meet all these dragons that were being rounded up, who were members of the British forces and some of the Australian forces, like my own battalion and the 2nd Pioneers, and Colonel Weary Dunlop's 2nd CCS forces. We had an amalgam of prisoners from all over the globe, and the camp constituted how many? Over 1,000 people, I suppose. It was rather difficult because rations, as one would have expected, I suppose, were not going to be of the highest order, and we had learned what it was to go without the type of food we had been accustomed to. We had learned that we were in the hands of another culture altogether that didn't possess the same way of life that we did, and we began to feel that life ahead was going to be a big question mark for us. Little by little, I became conscious of the fact that Weary's force, later to be known as Weary's Thousands, was being developed, and I was going to be a part of that future with Weary Dunlop.
I think we should reflect on that for a minute, because Weary Dunlop, a very significant figure in your life. Your recollections of his presence, his power, his command early on.
Well, when you're at the bottom of the heap, you don't get to get much information. We learned a lot by... It's not proper learning, is it? It's just rumour. So most of the information that was gathered at my level was rumour. But we still became an integral part of the entire camp. The camp was administered in a proper military manner. We had an adjutant. There was something worthy of remembering at that stage, because we did not have the ordinary toiletries, the ordinary amenities of civilian life. And some of our men were growing beards, and the Japanese people were not attracted to beards. They disliked the idea of our men growing beards, and they began to punish a few people. And so the camp adjutant was... Who's that fiery person? Oh dear, his name just escapes me for the moment, but I know it so well. He posted a daily order. Beards of a truculent, spade-like and revolutionary character will not be worn. Yes. So we adopted a different way of life and started to clean our faces a bit, and a part of that difficulty was disposed of.
But the spirit that Dunlop engendered amongst you, did it, do you think, increase your chances of survival to be led by such an inspiring man?
I don't know we had any idea at all. There was a lot of talent in the camp, and we began to learn things from other people. We had a community there that were... rather theatrical. Right. We also had premises there. There was a community hall in the Dutch camp which permitted the production of plays. And we had some rather colourful plays. We had competent playwrights and competent actors there. There were things that were able to absorb our time. I learned Pittman's shorthand from... a Tasmanian person, I think was a parliamentary reporter. Yes. He taught Pittman shorthand, and I became fairly competent at writing Pittman shorthand. The problem there, of course, was that I didn't have any pencils or paper to write on. But it was entertaining and interesting.
But from there, you were shipped to the line, the Burma Railway. Can you first describe the journey you took to get there, getting shipped there?
We knew that we had been gathered into this workforce. Yes. I didn't know it had a name. We got to know it later on as Weary's Thousands. From our Dutch camp, we went to Batavia, first of all. And we went to an encampment a few miles north of Batavia for some weeks before we got on an electric train and went back to Batavia port, Tanjung Priok. And there we boarded a ship. And we learnt a new experience there of how to get into a Japanese troop ship. You just crowd in, pile in. And after 3 days, I think, we got to Singapore. From Singapore, heavily guarded by Japanese machine gunners who made it quite apparent that there was to be no silly business at all, we arrived at the English barracks at Changi. Oh, yes. The name of those barracks, well known.
Selarang?
That's it.
Yes.
That's correct, yes. And we stayed there for perhaps 10 or 12 days. We just passed through, retaining our shape as a working battalion. That is to say, we were not separated, became part of the Changi camp. And after 10 or 12 days, the whole work battalion got onto the train at Singapore and went to Ban Pong, a trip of about 5 days, I think, to Ban Pong, which is just about on the border of Siam and Malaysia.
And I understand it didn't exactly travel in comfort to go up there.
No, there were no padded seats. They were steel trucks, and there were no seats. And there were, I think, 25 people to a carriage, and they were small trucks. So lying down space was very limited, and it was very much a sort of a knees-up space where you crammed in as best you can. Toilet facilities were nil. From time to time, the train would stop, and we were able to make toilet calls outside on the paddocks. And we would get a bucket of stew at the end of the day, which somehow or other was apportioned out to us, and we survived the 5 days all right to arrive at Ban Pong early one morning. And then our trial in Siam began.
Yes. And it went on a long time.
And the work
was relentless. Can you describe what you actually had to do, the work you were made to do?
Well, the first thing we had to do, of course, was to get to a work site. Yes. And I had no idea we were going to build a railway. If anyone had the idea we were going to build a railway, I don't know. But it became apparent after we had got from our train onto American Army trucks, we were driven some distance en route, a few miles out of Ban Pong. We saw a bridge under construction. On our left, as we drove north in Siam, there was a broad river, and there was a wooden bridge under construction. And we first got the idea that if you're going to build a bridge, there's going to be someone wants to cross it. Will it be a truck or will it be a train? So we could visualise the thought that maybe there'd be a train going there one day. But that idea was still not confirmed in my mind until much later on. Eventually we arrived at a sort of a halfway place, which we call Kanchanaburi, a colourful place which featured a great deal in the history of the construction of the line. Drove through Canberra and rested that night, having travelled a distance of, how far would it be? 100 kilometres perhaps, I'm only guessing. About 100 kilometres. The place we arrived at was adjacent to the River Kwai, and there was an encampment of British people there. British prisoners of war. We spent the night there, an uncomfortable night, and we became accustomed to the open pit latrines, which were going to be very much part of our lives in the future. the latrines were open and swarming with maggots. There were no toiletry provisions made for us in the way of cleanliness at all. We had a meagre rice tea, woke up early the next morning at dawn, got back onto the vehicles that we had previously travelled on, and went another 10 or 15 miles, whatever the distance might be, until we stopped on this roadway. It appeared to be on the edge of a plateau, and if you moved off the edge of the plateau, you'd look downhill. We moved out of the trucks and walked down that hill. It was a steep hill, and quite a problem to get down. I was never to understand for some time that part of that hillside that I walked down that day was going to be the site of a railway line that very same year. This was January of 1943. And that year there was going to be a railway line there. To me, we were in the middle of nowhere, the middle of a jungle, rather a menacing one. Tall trees, great bamboo thickets. There didn't seem to be any sign of human life. I had no idea where we were in Siam. I learned shortly after that that there was a British camp already established. When we walked down that steep hill, we arrived at the edge of the Kwinoy River. It was in the middle of the jungle, and Weary paraded us that night and explained that we were going to live here. But first we had to build a camp. And so we stuck where we were and ate some very meagre food, cut down bamboos, cut down trees, built huts, and after a few weeks we occupied the huts, and having occupied them, we then left them. After a total stay of perhaps 6 weeks at Konyu, we then climbed back up that hill we had previously laboriously climbed down, and having got to the top, we walked several miles along the plateau to our next stop, which was called Hintock, the Hintock Mountain Camp. At the Hintock Mountain Camp, that had been abandoned by an earlier working group, and we occupied that. And from that point, we began work in the building of the railway.
And in addition, of course, constant disease, constant abuse by the guards. Did you ever crack under that?
No. It was uncomfortable. We had no idea what our future might be. But we had a sense of togetherness. Yeah. And I think that in all human life, there's an element of adaptability. If you're on your own and you find yourself in a strange circumstance over which you have no control, it's appropriate to think, well, there's no future here for me. But when you have several hundreds of companions who all have the same problem, your problem is no more difficult than anyone else's. And somehow or other you find a common cause, and you can work together and even from time to time make fun of it. Yes. Although the seriousness of it began to dawn upon us, because shortly after that we were tremendously influenced by uncomfortable diseases, topped off by cholera, of course. Yes. And we began losing people. People died from starvation and beriberi and diarrhea and most unhygienic circumstances. So our compliments go to those people who showed us the way, the people who commanded us, the people, some of our officers who showed us the way and held us together, realised that we had to operate like soldiers as a workforce. And little by little we made progress. And in 12 months' time we built a railway line 420 kilometres long. And part of ran along that hillside that I had clambered down some time before. I went back there to see that spot. It took a bit of finding, but it was just so interesting to see it.
That was years after the war. I'd like to reflect on that a bit later.
Years afterwards.
Can I take you back to one incident in particular, or a series of incidents? If you're not comfortable talking about it, I quite understand, but I have read where you've referred to a medical treatment called glass rotting. Could you explain what glass rotting was?
The Japanese appear to be fairly meticulous about some things. They would initiate an action, but we never knew that it was followed through. Glass rotting was just the business of making sure that your back passage was clear of any germs, I suppose. And the glass rod was inserted and presumably transferred, the results transferred to a microscopic slide somewhere, and someone would say, well, this bloke's all right. Or maybe they didn't care anyway. I just have the impression that there were no medical centres at all where things could be developed on anything like a scientific process. So I don't know.
Because the Japanese carried out this act themselves.
The Japanese carried it out.
Was it painful? Was the process itself very painful? The glass rod insertion, how painful was that?
Oh, well, I didn't find it painful because it's only a process that takes a few seconds. It's not a laborious process. Just bend over and you're done.
The other constant factor surely was that of, I don't want to embarrass you, but humiliation. Did you sense that, and to what degree?
You can suffer all sorts of embarrassment, but again, it's this matter of adaptability. There's a procedure in the army known as the short arm parade. It's not the sort of thing that's talked about, but troops, even before we left Australia, well before we left Australia, early after our enlistment, we all had the short arm parade, which determined whether or not we harboured any venereal diseases at all.
For those who don't know, the short arm is...
Just lined up in a queue and you didn't go into a private room at all. That was just part of the deal.
For those who don't know, the short arm is the penis and they look underneath, yes. Mm. You're a tall man, a man of natural sense of presence and dignity, if I may say, but you had boy guards upbraiding you and assaulting you. How did you cope with that?
Well, that's part of the humiliation process. Every soldier under those circumstances, as a prisoner of war, you know you're going to be humiliated. I think you accept that fact. I've been knocked down several times by boy soldiers. If there was a time I cracked, it was shortly before the end of the war. This was in Japan, when there was some misdemeanour. I was caught in the act, and a young soldier, he might have been 17, Japanese soldier, he apprehended me. The usual form of punishment, we talk about bashing, a lot of the Japanese bashing is face slapping. You're slapped with an open hand, but you're slapped with all the force they can muster on the side of your face. This young man laid me out on a concrete floor, and I'd had enough, just about. But I picked up, and about 2 months after that, the war was over. So I suppose I got a bit lucky there.
We've got to take you there in our talk. You'd survived the railway, but there was more in store. You and many others were taken off by sea to Japan to work in the mines. And that meant a journey, a voyage, on what were known as the hell ships. A voyage of some 70 days. Can you take us back and describe that?
You're talking about the Bioki Maru, a Japanese ship which was a complete wreck, a rusted hulk, held together with welded-on girders, but capably captained through through a howling gale that sank some of the American Navy. It was a voyage of 10 weeks, 70 days, to go from Singapore to... We returned from Siam to Singapore to board the Biogi Maru, and 70 days later we arrived at the port of Mochi in Japan. We had not left ship in all that time. The food was very meagre. Oddly enough, we had not lost very many people. The circumstances were very uncomfortable, very crowded, most unhygienic. I don't know how many people we lost, but it would have been perhaps two or three, I don't know. But eventually we arrived at Ohama. From Ohama we were marched to purpose-built barracks just about a mile away, if it was a mile, from where we disembarked. Oh, I beg your pardon. At Moji we had to cross the inland sea to get to the port of Ohama, which was on the other island, on Honshu. And Moji is on Chushu. I hope I've got that right. So we had to cross the sea. But that only took a couple of hours. When we disembarked at Ohama, we went to these purpose-built barracks, a two-story place, unpainted pine, but luxurious by previous standards, because we had how many people to a room? Perhaps eight people to a room. We had mats, the traditional mats that the Japanese sleep on. There's a little pile of blankets made of very elementary wool or leftover stuff. And there was even a place for a bath, which was rather difficult to manage because there were such a lot of us.
Yes.
And the bath was a one which was shared by all at the one time simultaneously. So it's not a very satisfactory hygienic process. But it was lovely to go to sleep that night between blankets.
Yeah.
The difficulty arose shortly after because the blankets were heavily infested with lice and fleas and bed bugs. So part of the enjoyment was rather spoiled. However, we lived there for 12 months and began work in a mine. I've never known the full facts of the mine. The mine was under the sea, and I see it. It only had one entrance, and the entrance was at the same time the exit. And I don't know how it was ventilated. I know that it was very difficult to keep a cigarette alight working down in the mine. Not that I smoked at all, but other people did. We had no matches, of course, so people would light a cigarette by shorting the electric light wires overhead and lighting their cigarettes. And the cigarettes, I don't know, they're made of pine needles or something. For a short time, the Japanese had made provision for an issue of Kinchis, which was a Japanese, whether it's a brand name or just a name for a cigarette, I'm afraid I don't know. But a supply of Kinchis, perhaps five a day, was made available, but that soon petered out. A bit of a difficulty in a camp like that is that you don't have any matches, and people would light their cigarettes by, first of all, using the old Kapok and flint and steel striker. They would strike the flint on the steel and throw a spark into a little bit of Kapok, nurse that into a glow, get a smoke around, get a light from that, and spread the news. When the news was spread, people were looking for a light, would come. And I think the term we used was, he is here.
Yeah.
He being heat. He, we have he.
So this is 1944, you'd arrived at the mine.
Yes.
44. and you were put to work. Conditions in the mine, particularly in winter, what were they like?
Winter was difficult. Clothing had always been a problem. Our dress in winter was a pair of black cotton shirts, a black cotton vest. We had no underwear. We had no socks. And many of us had no shoes. Yeah. The Japanese did supply some of their single big toe canvas shoes. But most of the Japanese have small feet. Mm. And it was impossible to get a fit. So you'd take this small shoe and somehow or other strap it on your foot. And if you destroyed it, well, you just went barefooted. So it was difficult. And in the winter time, when it snowed heavily, lining up the lamp room up on the surface in your practically naked work clothes with a cloth cap in which you wore an electric lamp, we just shivered and waited to go down the ramp to our mine. You didn't even a cage to be lowered in a cage down to a mining level. You walked down a ramp through a tunnel to go under the surface of the sea. The tunnel was just on the edge of the sea, about 100, 200 metres from the edge of the sea. And I don't know the distance we walked, a kilometre or so perhaps, to where the work headings were. We were given an allocation of a number of trucks of coal that we had to mine. And when we had completed our allocation, then we were shepherded back to a specific place near the entrance of the mine, but still in the mine, until all the group was returned, and then we'd make our way back to camp.
What about food? You would have an evening meal after the end of this day's work, would you?
Oh, food, of course, is always rice. Yes. In the morning, we worked, I think, two shifts. Or was it three? I don't know. If you're working a day shift, you'd have your breakfast in the morning, which would be pap. Mm. You would also get an issue of rice, which you'd put in your bento box, and you'd take that with you.
Yes.
Oh, gosh, I hope I got this right. It was a long time ago, you know.
Could you describe the pap for people who don't know what its substance was?
Oh, I'll call it porridge.
Porridge, but
porridge made with rice instead of oats.
Yes.
Yes.
So this was a year of that. How important, therefore, to your survival was the dropping of the atom bomb? Would you have survived another year of that?
After that knockdown I had, which was only a couple of months before the end of the war, I don't think I would have.
No.
Maybe I would have, but I doubt it.
But peace did come, and what was the first you knew that the war was over?
The first I knew that the war was over was when I got up in the morning to have breakfast and to parade for my shift. But there was no one around. There were no Japanese. There was no breakfast. There was nothing. The lights were on. Our camp was electrically lit, by the way. The lights were on. There was no one around. However, the camp commandant was within the building. It would be difficult to describe the building to you, but the camp commandant had an office within the premises where we were imprisoned. He was there. And we would hear a telephone ring, and we were gathered pretty much adjacent to the camp commandant's office. We did hear some voices being relayed, but we could not understand what they were. But yes, there was a thin voice, and I believe that the camp commandant was relaying the emperor's message, but he was not relaying it publicly. We could overhear something happening. It was sheer surmise on our part that we were listening to the emperor's surrender. But Other than that, we had no knowledge that the bomb had gone off, other than a little bit of rumour the day before.
So throughout this time, the railway, the voyage on the Hell Ship, slave labour in the mine, what awareness, if any, did you have of the progress of the war, of news? Did you have any information at all?
I had none. I don't believe there was any secret information there. There was an English newspaper, a Japanese newspaper in English, that bob up from time to time. It would be illegally imported in the camp, but it usually bore propaganda messages. One concerned the pilot of a Zero who had run out of ammunition, and he was opposed to an American fighter, and so he, in despair, he just threw his binto box at the American fighter, and the binto box struck the propeller and disabled the aircraft. So stories of that nature appeared in the newspaper, and that was probably the purpose of the paper, rather than to disseminate news of any progress in the Pacific. Progress in the Pacific was an empty book to me until many, many years afterwards, when I came home, a person gave me a book. There it is, there, see it? The Pacific War.
Pacific War, yes.
Costello. I read and read and read that book, and it was a fantastic book to read.
So you were relieved from your shift at the mine. Who were the first people you saw? Did they send an Allied unit? Did they send some officers, information people? Who did they use to convey to you the fact you were no longer POWs?
Well, we had our own forces, officers, who had no authority within the camp, but they were still our... we respected them as our senior officers. I don't know that they knew anything either. But things just seemed to happen. We lived by rumour, as I mentioned, at the lower end of things, we lived by rumour. American aircraft would fly by. I got an instruction to go up on the roof of one of the buildings with a bucket of paint, and to put 400 up there, which I did. And that was supposed to be an indication to flyers that there were 400 prisoners. So someone must have sent a message to our camp that instructed someone at our camp to instruct someone to get up on the roof and paint a number there. I've since found, on looking back in history, I have a photograph of Ohama, and I see those barracks, and I see the number 400 painted on there, but it's far more elaborate than the 400 I wrote there, and I don't know how that got there.
What sort of shape were you in? Your weight must have dropped dramatically, physically, after all this. How were you?
Well, I don't know how people were weighed. Many people have told me they only weighed so much, but I was never weighed. I never saw any scales at all. When I came home, I was weighed, and I've got no idea what my weight was then. But by the time I'd got home, I can tell you that I'd put on a bit.
You were flown out, I believe, initially. Is that right? Flown from Japan?
My repatriation was quite, in its own way, quite a spectacular evacuation, because when I first began my repatriation from Ohama, my first journey was on a railway line up the west coast of Japan and then back again, so to detour widely away from Hiroshima to go to a place called Wakayama, which was on the southeast tip of Honshu, perhaps, as good as I can put it. And there was an American base there where we were processed. We walked along a beach, and parallel with the beach was a rope fence. And we were told to toss everything we had over the rope fence and walk naked into the processing place. Well, we hung on to a few things, which was quite illegal. And when we got to the processing place, the Americans were there with the... for want of a word, I can only call them spray guns, yeah. With DDT powder. We were squirted all over with DDT powder. We were alive, of course, with all sorts of animals, creatures. After that, we went into a most beautiful hot shower and we were introduced to soap, the first soap I had seen in years. Had a lovely hot shower with plenty of soap. And an American Comforts Fund string bag, the toiletries in it, toothbrush and toothpaste. It was heaven. It was heaven. These things are just so deeply etched in my mind, so deeply etched, that I just can't bring them all to mind. It's such a powerful influence at the time to know that it was all over except the journey home.
Yes.
Well, my departure from Wakayama was on an American hospital ship, a brand new American hospital ship, because the Americans, I understand, had intended, had it been necessary, to land on Japan when there would have been some of the most grotesque and unimaginable atrocities of the war would have been committed. But the bomb ended that. I was on the hospital ship and I was offloaded at the Japanese island of Okinawa, which of course was a huge American base. There were literally thousands of aircraft on Okinawa. The camps were not buildings, they were just open camps with a few tents, and I slept outside for a couple of nights there. It was a land of plenty, a land of plenty. There's a spot where you could go down and get a bottle of Coke and walk away and join the circle, join the crowd, drink your Coke and come back again in half an hour's time and get another bottle. Just the continuity of people lining up for their Coke. It was just so wonderful. And that evening, I've told this story on so many occasions before, but it's so deeply riveted in my mind. It was a balmy evening. We'd had tea, a most magnificent tea. I was full of turkey and apple pie and Coca-Cola. And it was dusk. And we had a movie projector rigged up and a screen. And the screen showed a group of dairy cows, black and white dairy cows, walking along a post and rail fence. And I was watching this, being full, as I say, of apple pie and Coca-Cola. And this little group of cows, black and white cows, were walking along this fence. And the Andrews sisters were singing. And they were singing, "Don't Fence Me In." And as they sang, so the vessels of the cows moved in beautiful unison. And my cup was full.
Yes. A lovely moment.
My cup was full.
And from there, from that moment of contemplation and reflection and gratitude for being alive, back you came to Australia via the Philippines, I understand, on a B-29.
Well, after Okinawa, a few days, I got into a B-29 bomber and flew from Okinawa to Manila, to another American camp. That was a very interesting stay. I was there for a few days. I believe there's still a bit of Japanese activity in the hills north of this camp, Clark Base, I think it was called. And I remember being impressed by seeing some in the camp I'm speaking of right now, in the tents in the camps, there were some bomb-like looking black vessels holding about a pint and a half in our measure and just moulded into the shape of a capsule.
Mm-hmm.
Capsule. And I think the capsule was plastic. And they were press-the-button mosquito sprays. I thought they were going to be something a little bit more dangerous and that. But no, that, you press the button and the mosquitoes would go away. So things were changing. And I saw a helicopter. And I remember that an Englishman was nearby at the time, and it was the first time he had seen a helicopter. He was an Englishman. And he said, "Oh, Lord, he's a helicopter." So there was been helicopters to me.
I like that. So then ship to Australia, train to Adelaide, and he met an old pal here, an old friend from Broken Hill, I believe.
Having left Manila, I finished my journey to Australia on an aircraft carrier.
Mm-hmm.
I was met at Sydney by my father.
Mm-hmm.
I was so pleased to see him, and so full of guilt.
Yes.
He had aged. He had aged. But it was lovely to be reunited with him. He had come from Broken Hill to Sydney to greet me. My journey was not finished, because the next day I went to Melbourne by train together with the rest of the company that I had been travelling with. And my father was in Melbourne also. And we were entertained at some very, very gracious facility, probably entertained by the Red Cross and given a meal. And after just one night at Melbourne, we caught the train again to Adelaide, where I was met by my old friend Jack Bullwinkle.
Now, Jack Bullwinkle, brother to?
Yes, Vivian. Brother to Vivian Bullwinkle.
Yes.
I had been to high school with Jack, and he had been shot down in the desert and parachuted, but badly injured, and he had survived the fall. But it was so nice to be greeted by him, and after that, of course, I became immersed in the Broken Hill Society again.
Yes.
And within a week, I was pushing a bike around Broken Hill, working in the grocery shop.
But that didn't last, because economic times changed and it was very hard to run an independent business. Can you reflect on that at all?
Although the times have changed, of course. The war was over. Broken Hill was a prosperous town. Holden decided making motor cars. People had their own motor cars. They no longer had to depend on a grocer knocking on the door and saying, "What do you want delivered this week?" The grocer would take the order back to the shop, assemble the order, write out the invoice, do all the bookwork associated with it, load the orders into tea chests, put them into a truck and go out and deliver them. And then you'd wait a fortnight to get your money. Well, prior to that, residents had no option but to depend upon their local grocer. Shortly after that, of course, people began shopping on the pay-as-you-go basis, and all the business of collecting orders and delivering orders went overboard. So too was the problem of receiving payment for the transaction. I just could not compete with that, or we could not compete with that. Shortly after that, my father died and I inherited the shop. Shops could not be traded, businesses could not be sold, they were not marketable. So I just shut the shop and walked away from it. But I was lucky, because while I was in the process of closing down the shop, a person came to visit me. He was the chief accountant on the Zinc Corporation. The Zinc Corporation was the biggest mine in Broken Hill at that stage. It later became Rio Tinto Zinc, and it became an international force, of course. And he offered me a job. Well, I had no qualifications. I had no education to speak of. I had no skills, except that I had been doing a correspondence course with a Melbourne firm of, what was the name of that firm? I cannot think.
It was Home Tutoring by Correspondence. I wish I could think of the name of the company as well, but the Hemingway Robertson.
Hemingway Robertson.
Hemingway Robertson. Institute. Yes, yes.
They were very good. Yes. You did everything by correspondence. And I had worked my way pretty successfully to a point where I was ready to take final examinations.
Yeah.
But by that stage, too, I had married and had a couple of children. And I took my final examinations before I was ready for them, mm-hmm. and failed the subject. And by that time, it was too late for me to go back and do it again. So I never got my letters. However, this gentleman who came to visit me offered me a job at a club. Clubs and hotels had never been part of my background, never ever. But the job that he offered me was attractive and seemed simple enough. The secretary manager of the Broken Hill Club. Now, the Broken Hill Club was just one of many, many clubs in Broken Hill. But it also had another name, and its other name was the Mine Managers Club. I took the job, and it was a pushover. And I ran the books of the club and managed the staff for, I think, a couple of years. And I got to know every person of consequence. When I say consequence, I mean in business and big business. The mine managers, the bank managers, the solicitors, the professionals in Broken Hill. And after some time working at the club, a person came in to see me and offered me a directorship in a local company which was associated with the mining industry. The mining industry consumed huge quantities of timber in shoring up its stopes and development. That timber came from the west coast of America, Oregon, and there were literally millions of super feet of timber lying in railway yards in Broken Hill, and there was a mill in Broken Hill which milled the timber to mining sizes. The company of which I became a director had done a lot of investigation into mining timber, and they had demonstrated that by using Australian hardwood, you could get commensurate loads for smaller dimensions. Instead of using, say, a 10 inch by 10 inch beam, that's 100 square inches, you could use a 9 by 9 of Australian hardwood. That's 81 square inches. That's a reduction of 19% in the amount of timber you need and still have commensurate strength. And we had mills at Oberon in New South Wales and associated mills up on the north coast of New South Wales. And for years I remained there with that firm and eventually opened up an accessory to the firm selling ordinary building materials. And I had a very, very happy and industrious and successful business life in Broken Hill.
From unexpected sources, it was a surprise to you, but it came good, and the boy from the grocer's shop forged a most rewarding career in civilian life after a most adventurous and at times terrible, stressful war. But Jack, there was more to come. In retirement, late in life, you were selected to take part in a goodwill mission to Japan. An astonishing sentimental, sorry, urge of emotion must have overcome you when you reached Japan again in your 90s. Can you take me through what you experienced on that occasion?
It's something that I could never have thought would have happened. It came as a complete surprise. A telephone call from Josh Featherston, a man who worked at the Japanese consulate in Melbourne. Prior to that, I'd had some correspondence, I think from the RSL. I'm just rather vague about that, but it would have been the RSL, inviting me to nominate if I chose to compete for a place in a group of Japanese ex-prisoners of war who would be invited to visit Japan at the expense of the Japanese government. Well, I had once won a chicken in a raffle at the Pick and Whistle Hotel. That's about the only time I'd ever won anything in a raffle. But I put my name down. And I was surprised when Josh Featherston rang up to say, well, something's going to happen. And it did happen. I got the invitation to go. Eventually I went with a party of two other Japanese and myself, together with escorts, which we had chosen ourselves. I took a son of mine, another survivor of the prisoner of war situation and in the same battalion as me, Keith Fowler, took his son. Another person was from Western Australia. So there were three Australian former prisoners of war constituted the party that was to visit Japan on an official visit to Japan. That was a most wonderful surprise. When we travelled to Japan, we were met at the airport, travelling first class on the airways. We were met at the airport by three women. The three women who had been delegated to care for us for our stay of a week in Japan. Those ladies were the official guides and superintendents of our visit. One of them came from the Foreign Office. One of them was, let's say, a guide leader and a diminutive and charming lady and thoroughly versed in guiding and knowing her way around Japan. And the third person was a young person, a nurse. They had a van, not a van, a small coach. The coach would have accommodated, I suppose, a dozen or more people. And that coach and a volunteer driver, a most excellent driver, by the way, I'd never drive anything in Japan, most excellent driver. And those three ladies and our companions were made very much at home. The ladies were gracious and modest, kind and extremely helpful, and their companionship was there all the time. They took us to various places of interest in Japan. The Japanese government made available a trip for myself and Keith Fowler, to visit the place where I had served in a mine, where I had worked in a mine. That was a three-hour flight away from Tokyo.
What were your impressions then of Japanese people and Japanese society, contrasting that goodwill mission with what you'd experienced in your previous encounter with them?
We encountered nothing but goodwill. We were taken to meet the foreign minister. He met us in his office. He sat us down and talked to us. He spoke kindly to us and reaffirmed to us the attitude of the Japanese government to our former prisoners of war. Wherever we went, we found generosity and kindness of spirit and friendship, and always quite conspicuously noticeable was the modesty of the people that took us. Can I show you something?
You can indeed, and I'll describe it to anyone listening to the interview. Jack now has got a very small fan, beautifully made, and on the back, "Dear Mr. Jack Renton Thomas," these are messages from the people who looked after you on your trip to Japan. "I miss you already. You are so gentleman. Thank you for coming back to Japan."
This little message is from Sasha. She was our nurse.
Beautiful.
Sasha would come into our room at night and take our blood pressure and our pulse and temperature.
And here we have Kimiko Mitani saying, "I can see you again in Australia."
Yes.
And she will too.
So I value that. I treasure that.
Beautiful. Not only did you do that, but you've also been on missions back to the line, back to the railway.
Yes, that is so.
That must have been an incredibly moving experience.
It was. When I arrived at the line in 1943, it's very, very hilly country, very steep, very heavily timbered, and thickets of great thickets of bamboo. Because of the forestry, you don't have a line on the horizon. You see the sky rather than the horizon. And frequently, while I was working on the line, I had no idea in what direction I was working. And I could not construct in my mind the direction that the line was taking, because I'd work at a different site from time to time and approach it from a different direction. And the configuration of the line had always puzzled me. And it was that curiosity that drove me to go back there. In the first place, I took my boys back there. And those little problems I had in my mind were all straightened out. I know all about the line now in retrospect. But since then, I went back to the line under the auspices of the Australian government. And on Anzac Day, 2000 and... when would it have been? 14? What day? I attended the Anzac Day performance at the Conu cutting, where some of Weary's ashes are interred. And I was overcome.
I wanted to reflect on this right at the end of our interview now, and thank you so much for your generosity of spirit and such remarkable recollections of what you've been through. You took a pilgrimage also to the Australian War Memorial in Canberra, and speaking and thinking of Weary, you wrote these words in your subsequent memoirs. I sat at the feet of a statue of Weary and ate a frugal lunch. At peace with myself, I contemplated the life of this modest and great man. He stands there in grace, unmoved by the present, a perpetual reminder of the torments of the past. To what extent now are you at peace? To what extent have you overcome the torments of the past?
I feel exactly the same now as I felt then. I have admiration for the courage of that man and others of his like. And there were others. There are my own companions who shared the same spirit. I'm proud to think that we weathered the storm and left a lot of people behind. I feel a great deal of compassion for them and for their families, their friends and families. I wonder how it is that at 96 years of age, almost 97 years of age, how I could have been spared after those torments were just as real. I feel just as real now as they were years ago. So I've been a very privileged person.